Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. I'm the author of The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion, The 30-Day Vegan Challenge, and my most recent book, The Joyful Vegan, How to Stay Vegan in a World That Wants You to Eat Meat, Dairy, and Eggs. You can find me at joyfulvegan.com and, of course, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you so much to subscribing to Food for Thought at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for sharing it with others, leaving ratings and reviews, and supporting it. Food for Thought is a 100% listener-supported podcast, so please become a supporter today at patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau to support this podcast. Thank you so much in advance. Also, if you are interested in traveling with me to fabulous destinations around the world, vegan style, please visit CPG Trips, CPG for Colleen Patrick Gaudreau, trips.com. We've got space in our France trip this summer, 2020 summer, which will be the last trip you'll be able to sign up for with me in 2020. Botswana is in December of 2020, but it's already sold out. So check out cpgtrips.com and make sure you join the mailing list. Today's episode is 5 favorite foods: bananas, sweet potatoes, cauliflower, popcorn, and Casa Voltrano olives. Hi, everyone. I hope you're doing fabulously well. A lot of you have been urging me to do another episode of my 5 favorite foods series. And so as proof that I take your suggestions seriously, here it is. If you're interested in past episodes I've done on my favorite foods, they include 5 favorite foods. These are the podcast episode names. 5 favorite foods: carrots, dates, walnuts, oats, Brussels sprouts. 5 favorite foods: quinoa, kale, blueberries, tempeh, and tea. Yes, tea. For the Love of Lentils is another one. 5 favorite Japanese foods: miso, sushi, agar, sea vegetables, and shiitake mushrooms. And there's an episode called Favorite Foods, Beans. Now, I also just wrote an episode. It will be next up. It'll be coming up. This is the last episode for 2019. So that one you'll find in 2020, that one being an update on those past episodes, emphasizing some changes to those past lists in terms of how I'm able to get them zero waste, i.e. plastic-free, i.e. package-free. So for instance, if tempeh, miso, carrots, and dates are indeed still my favorite foods, and you'll have to listen to find out if they are, big suspense, I know. If they are indeed still my favorite foods, how am I able to find them in zero waste, plastic-free packaging? So check out that episode once it airs. It's called How Zero Waste Has Changed the Way I Eat and Why Baby Carrots Are Evil. But since so many of you have been asking me to do another episode about more of my favorite foods, here we are focusing on 5 more favorites: bananas, sweet potatoes, cauliflower, popcorn, and Casa Voltrano olives. I'm asked so often what I eat on a given day, and while I do eat a lot of variety, and there are a few foods I don't like or eat, I do eat pretty simply throughout the day. And even though these sound like boring foods, don't you ever call bananas boring, even though to some of you these might sound like boring foods, I'm going to talk today about my favorite methods for preparing them, which may inspire you to add them to your regular repertoire. Now, one thing I want to add: someone asked me on social media if I have any podcast episodes on how to learn to love to cook. She said because she hates it. And while I don't have a particular episode on that in particular, though I'm now inspired to write one, what do you think? Would you like an episode on how to be inspired to cook? Because I'm interested in writing that. I have talked in past episodes, though, about how having just a few simple kitchen tools will make a difference in terms of how you enjoy cooking or whether you do or not. One episode in particular comes to mind. It's called 5 Favorite Kitchen Tools, which I encourage you to listen to. And I'll say this much: having a good knife and a good cutting board will make all the difference in terms of enjoying cooking. But you'll have to listen to the episode for more on that. Now, if you really want to know what my least favorite foods are, you're going to have to wait for that episode's. Actually, they don't merit their own podcast episode. So here goes. Many of you have already heard me talk about how I think cilantro is the spawn of Satan. Some of you may call it coriander, but for those in the States, coriander is the seed and cilantro is the leaf of the same plant. So for the record, I love coriander. I love the seed, but I hate cilantro. I hate the leaf. I hate it with a passion of a thousand suns. And yes, yes, I know you love it. And how is it even possible that I hate it? Well, I could ask the same of you. How is it even possible that you want to eat it? Now you're going to ask me if I think it tastes like soap. Well, I don't know how soap tastes because I don't eat soap. But if I did, the answer would be no, it just tastes awful to me. I can't even stomach the smell. If I go into a grocery store and someone's chopping it or anywhere, if I just smell it, I cannot stand the smell of it. The reason people think it might taste like soap to me and to fellow cilantro haters is because apparently, according to a genetic survey by researchers at Cornell University, there's a very specific gene that makes some people strongly dislike the taste of cilantro high me. And after surveying nearly 30,000 people, the scientists singled it down to the OR6A2 gene. This gene codes for the receptor that picks up the scent of aldehyde chemicals. And these chemicals are found in cilantro and soap, which is why many people anecdotally say cilantro tastes like soap. But again, to me, it just tastes gross. And for the record, I did eat soap once. My mother literally washed my mouth out with soap once, which was a horrifying and disgusting experience. Still, eating cilantro is worse. Okay, I've made my point. But here's one more fun fact about coriander. It's an animalogy. Now, if you're just joining me for the first time and you have no idea what I'm talking about, an animalogy is the word I've coined to refer to an animal-related word or expression. So an animalogy is an animal-related word or expression. And I talk a lot about animalogies on this Food for Thought podcast, but because I'm so interested in this topic, I'm writing a book on it, and I already created a spinoff podcast, which many of you have already subscribed to. It's called Animalogy, which you can find wherever you listen to podcasts. And yes, it's been on hold because with the new book, I wasn't able to juggle everything, but I do intend to bring back animalogy, especially when I write the book. So coriander is possibly an animalogy because coriander, or more specifically, Coriandrum sativum, derived from the Greek corianin, is, some say, or botanists say, may be related to chorus, and this is spelled K-O-R-I-S, it's Greek, so it's K-O-R-I-S, chorus, which means bedbug. Now, my main source, which is the Oxford English Dictionary, does not mention this, but another source I use for animalogies, or for etymologies, I should say, does mention this. So right now it's conjecture, but it's interesting and supports my disdain for cilantro even more. I don't know why it does. Doesn't really. But I'll look into this more as I start delving deeper into animalogies for the book. Now, it's really funny though, because the number of times I've eaten cilantro by accident, as much as I hate it, is kind of ridiculous, mainly because I forget that it's in so many different cuisines. And so when I'm eating out, I often get a dish and then I forget to say, please, no cilantro, even if they don't have cilantro, because I just forget. And so David, my husband, has pointed out how ridiculous it is that given my dislike for it, I never, you know, I don't mention it as much as I should. He said, you know, that I never accidentally ordered, you know, something with meat, dairy, or eggs because I always asked, you know, please, hey, make sure there's no meat, dairy, or eggs. And I need to do that with cilantro. So I know it's just, I'm a slow learner apparently because it's been years that I've known I hate cilantro. And yet there are so often times that I get a dish and I'm like, oh my God, I can't, there's cilantro. So I'm getting better. Although give me some credit because when we went to Vietnam, knowing that cilantro is in a lot of Vietnamese dishes, no cilantro was the first thing I learned to say in Vietnamese. I don't remember how to say it now, so don't ask me. Now, other foods I don't like, I don't love eggplant. It has to be cooked just right for me to like it. And I find that's often the case when I have it in Asian restaurants. Or to be more accurate, I find Asian eggplant, like Chinese or Japanese eggplant, it's something that's often better prepared than Italian or globe eggplant. So if I'm going to order eggplant, it's usually going to be in a Thai or a Japanese restaurant. But I don't hate eggplant. It's just not my favorite. What else? I would have talked about this on the shiitake episode. I was once a mushroom hater, but I'm now a mushroom lover. And though I still don't love white button mushrooms, I could probably take them or leave them. Otherwise, I am so glad I now see the light where mushrooms are concerned because they're amazing and I can't imagine life without shiitake mushrooms. And I guess the last one would be okra. I hate okra. I just don't like okra, but that's it. Those are the foods I don't like. The most important thing is what are the foods I love? The foods that are, in fact, my favorite. Foods that I eat on a regular basis because I love them to bits and pieces. So we'll start with this list. We'll start with bananas. I love bananas. Like, how amazing is this food with its perfect packaging? It's so insanely cool. I love that they're perfectly packaged. Now, like every other person who has an opinion about their preference, I prefer my bananas with brown spots. I don't like any green on my bananas at all. They don't have to be super, super brown, but to eat them, they have to have some brown and no green. Of course, the only downside with bananas is that they don't transport very well. So when I'm on the road or if I'm traveling, there's something I usually get at an airport or I grab from home and I eat in a relatively short period of time. Now, apples or other hard fruits are easier to transport, obviously making them easier to pack and take on a plane since they don't get bruised and soft like bananas do. But so what? They have limitations like we all do. Nobody's perfect, not even bananas. Now, eating them straight, however, I do eat bananas straight pretty often, but that's not the main way I consume bananas, the several times a week I do consume bananas. And it's not in smoothies either. It's as nice cream. Now, nice cream, of course, is the name, I don't know who coined it, but it's the name given to the ice cream created by just blending frozen bananas. And let me tell you something, I never buy commercial ice cream anymore. Making nice cream instead of eating commercial ice cream, making that your go-to frozen treat will... first of all, I think it'll change your life. I don't know if it changed my life, but I love it so much. But it will definitely cut down on needless packaging, and it also cuts down on cost. And of course, it's a lot healthier than ice cream. Of course, even the dairy-free ice cream, which of course is delicious and I love. Don't even get me started on So Delicious's, what is it, caramel almond crunch? I don't know, something ridiculously delicious. I love it, but I don't buy it anymore because of the packaging. And because of the calories, I could eat a pint in a sitting. It's ridiculous. But once, you know, like with anything, I often tell people this when they're finally not eating meat, dairy, and eggs, or when they're contemplating not eating meat, dairy, and eggs, is that your palate changes. And certainly it's the case when it comes to something really sugary. If you're used to high sugar ice cream, and that includes dairy-free ice cream, and believe me, that's what I grew up on. My father owned ice cream stores. When you stop, or at least when you switch to, just fruit, and getting your sugar from natural sugars, getting the sweetness from the natural sugars in fruit, when you go back to eating a commercial, really sugary ice cream, it's almost uneatable. It's almost inedible. Inedible, same thing, because it's so sweet. And so once you start eating nice cream, especially if you're really ripening those bananas, I guarantee you that it will satisfy whatever sweet craving you have. So here's my go-to recipe for nice cream. You start with very ripe bananas. Well, frozen bananas. So let's pause. You can certainly buy a bunch of green bananas and then just let them sit on your counter to ripen. I don't even like the smell of green bananas, but you can buy a bunch of green bananas. You can let them sit on your counter to ripen, to oxidize, to get brown, to get nice and sweet. The browner they are, the sweeter they are. Or you can buy brown bananas at your grocery store and you can buy them for cheap. Whenever I go to the store, if there are bananas on the shelf that are already pretty ripe, I always ask if they'll give me a lower price on them because they're just going to throw them out once they're no longer able to sell them because they're too brown. And they always do. The clerks always give me a lower price. And I only ask when they're like super, super brown. They always lower the price for me. So that's tip number one. Tip number two is to buy those ripe brown bananas and freeze them right away, unless you want to ripen them even more on your counter. I usually buy bunches and bunches that will, as I said, invariably get thrown out by grocery stores, and I freeze them right away. How to freeze them? peel them first. Some people think you can just freeze bananas as they are in their skin and then be able to add them to a blender to make an ice cream or smoothie in a pinch, but that's not true. If you freeze bananas with their skin on, it's impossible to peel them once they're frozen. I mean, you can do this, but they're a pain to peel once they're frozen. Now, when you freeze them in their peel, the peels will turn completely black. Don't be alarmed. The banana is totally fine. You can do this, but it's just impossible to get the peel off once it's frozen this way. You have to wait until it starts thawing, and that kind of defeats the purpose. So it's just a lot easier to peel the bananas first, compost the skin, compost the peel, and then break the banana up into chunks and store in plastic bags or glass or plastic containers. My freezer is pretty much just fruit I've frozen from fresh fruit I bought and then added to the freezer. I talk in the episode how zero waste has changed the way I eat, why baby carrots are evil, about how I used to buy frozen fruit in plastic bags from Trader Joe's. I used to get a ton of frozen fruit from Trader Joe's. I love frozen blueberries. Like, I would eat them out just like that, just like frozen, completely frozen. I love them. They were like candy. But I don't do that anymore because I'm choosing to not get the packaging. So anyway, you can listen to that episode for more about that and how to freeze fruit in general. How to freeze, you know, fresh fruit that you get at the grocery store or the farmer's market that's not in packaging. Now, to be clear, I said you can freeze your bananas in plastic bags. I don't buy plastic bags. I haven't bought plastic bags even before I officially went zero waste. I've not purchased, you know, Ziploc bags in years and years because David and I, many, many years ago, I still accumulated plastic bags when I would go to, say, the farmer's market. And this was before I was, you know, just consciously only bringing my own cloth bags and cotton bags and mesh bags to the farmer's market. But there, you know, I would get plastic bags from the farmer's markets and then bring them home, and then we would wash them. So we have a little plastic bag or any kind of bag stand to dry them on. And we still use that because invariably somehow you're going to get a plastic bag in your life. It just happens. It's just the reality. And so those are the plastic bags that I use. I just keep washing them, and I just use them until eventually they're just not going to be usable anymore, and they will eventually go to the landfill. But I'd rather use what I have, even if they're plastic bags. The majority of the fruit in my freezer, however, is in glass and Tupperware containers. In plastic in this case, you know, the very thick Tupperware containers. Do I have a concern about that for frozen food? No, I don't. I will continue to do my own research around that, but I'm not concerned at this point about the plastic that's in the Tupperware containers for frozen bananas. Now, I would say that there's evidence that putting hot foods in a plastic container could leach chemicals from that plastic into the food. That's different though for a frozen. It just doesn't have the same effect. So at this point, I do use a combination of glass and plastic. And eventually I am planning on just continuing to never buy the plastic containers again. I mean, even though these are reusable, I just would prefer glass. And I do. And actually a lot of the jars that you see me often on social media washing out, so we do buy some glass jars, and we have some, for instance, for like a mayonnaise or something. I wash those out. Those jars are perfect for just putting the fruit in. So my freezer just is filled with glass jars, glass containers, and some plastic Tupperware with all of my frozen fruit. I usually use the smaller jars for the smaller fruit, like the strawberries or something like that. And so you can also, some people suggest that you first spread the bananas out on a cookie sheet and then you freeze them like that so that they're all spread out and they don't stick together. A lot of people will tell you to do the same thing with other fruits or vegetables that, you know, blanched vegetables that you're going to freeze. I don't tend to do that. They do stick together a little bit when they're in their containers, but I just break them up using a butter knife or my hands when I do want to use them. But you can avoid that if you want to freeze them first in a single layer, and then, you know, so freeze them that way and then add them to your container so that you avoid them sticking together. You can prevent them sticking together. But basically, that's the next step you do. Once you buy your very ripe or you have very ripe bananas, peel them, break them up into chunks, and then add them to a container or a bag to the freezer. Now, related to tip number one and number two is the fact that millions of bananas are thrown away every year as a matter of course. It's quite obscene. We produce this monocrop, we use a ton of water, and in many cases, pesticides and such. We export it from tropical regions all around the world, and we throw out millions of perfectly edible pieces of fruit once they reach their destination. We are all responsible for this, and I hope you listen to my food waste series that I did. There are three podcast episodes on this podcast on Food for Thought, specifically on food waste, and I really urge you to listen. It's changed, you know, so much of how I interact with the things I bring into my life, including food, and it was really enlightening for me, and I'm enthralled by this topic of food waste. So related to bananas specifically, a recent study from Sweden found that, quote, a mere 7 fruits and vegetables represented about half of all produce that goes to waste in supermarkets, and bananas is one of them. And that's just grocery stores. Less food waste is produced in retail, in grocery stores, than in households, but retailers also waste large amounts of food each year. We can all do better. Most food waste is actually from the homes, from our homes, from the home. So listen to the Food for Thought episode specifically on food waste if you want to learn more and if you want to learn how we can all do better and how we can make some improvements, especially in our own kitchens regarding food waste. Now, obviously, retailers need to do a better job of not wasting food. We can all do better in our homes. But just saying, buying already ripe bananas that will never sell and will be thrown away is a great way to reduce food waste at stores. Put them in your freezer right away and boom, you're set. I go through mine pretty quickly, but they can be stored for up to 6 months. After that, they're just going to get freezer burn. They're not going to kill you. They're just going to get freezer burn. They're not going to be fresh. They're not going to be as good. If they last that long in your freezer, I will be amazed. But keep in mind that you can also mash bananas up first as well, and you can store them that way and then use them as in baked goods. Either way, whether you freeze them as chunks or as, you know, mashed up, when you want to make something like my famous banana chocolate chip muffins from the Joy of Vegan Baking, first you want to just thaw them out for like an hour. Won't take long to thaw just a bit of banana. It's a good argument for freezing them in smaller batches so that if you do want just exactly what you need for a baked good recipe, for instance, you have exactly what you need and you can just thaw that jar. And then once it's thawed, you can just add them to the recipe. It's like a great way to just have on hand what you would normally not. I mean, how many times have you wanted to bake something like, I don't know, banana bread or banana muffins, and you didn't have ripe bananas? Now you can just, you know, kind of be forward thinking and have those ripe bananas in your freezer and bake them whenever you want for smoothies, or, you know, use them for smoothies, for ice cream, or for bread. Now back to nice cream. My go-to recipe is I add those frozen chunks to a blender. Now I usually do the equivalent of 2 bananas, which makes a lot of nice cream. So, and then I add whatever other fruit I want to add. This is all frozen fruit. By the way, I have done it where I add kind of sometimes I'll have like a super soft ripe banana that I do add to the blender with the frozen bananas, you know, so a fresh banana, and it actually adds just even more texture and flavor and sweetness, but generally it's just frozen bananas and then frozen fruit in addition. I usually do strawberries because I just get flats and flats of strawberries at the farmer's market every week and just, like I said, freeze them in jars. And yes, you can freeze them without having to cut the tops off. I usually do, but you don't have to. In fact, the leaves on the tops of strawberries are very nutritious. So you can just freeze them all like just right from the flat and put them right into your jars and containers. So I usually do strawberries, but blueberries and cherries, especially cherries, are so delicious. So whatever other, it could be mango, could be pineapple, whatever you want to add, add your other fruit, or it could just be bananas. It doesn't have to be other fruit. And then here's the thing you're going to love. I add about a tablespoon of unsweetened cocoa, or you can just add cacao nibs or whatever you want. It just adds, oh my gosh, just it's delicious. Like, so it's just basically a chocolate and ice cream. Then I add a small amount of cold water. Yes, you can use water. You don't need milk. When I have homemade soy milk in the fridge, I add it, but otherwise I just use cold water and it's perfect. You would never know the difference. It's not like you need it. You're not getting any more thickness because the thickness or the thinness is coming from the consistency based on how much liquid you add. So I just add cold water. It's probably about a quarter cup, depends on how many bananas. You'll get to kind of be familiar with how much you need to add. I add just enough to create the thicker consistency I want to allow the bananas to blend. And I put the blender first on low. Just let everything start to mix. If you put it on high, the blade's going to whiz around and it's not going to get any of the fruit. Now, if you have a Vitamix, you can use the tamper on the Vitamix, obviously to keep pushing everything down. But for those of us who just have regular blenders, I have a BlendTec that don't have tampers. I just usually turn the blender on low, get it started, but then invariably the fruit kind of clings to the side of the blender pitcher, and then the blade is just spinning around. So I turn the blender off. I use a wooden spoon to knock the fruit around, get it back into that blade, maybe add a little more water if necessary, and then I turn the blender back on again. And I do that until I have the consistency I want. I often actually add ground flax seeds as well. And then, so it's all blended, and I would do the flax seeds early on. Once it's all blended, and no, I don't add any sweetener. You don't have to add any sweetener at all. It's so sweet because the bananas are so ripe. Then I just add it to a bowl, and then I add whatever cut up fruit. I know it sounds crazy, but I love cut up apples in my ice cream. I love having just a texture that contrasts with the creamy banana ice cream. But you can add any fruit that you like. I add some cacao nibs. And I was never someone who loved cacao nibs. It's just the cocoa nibs. They're just unsweetened cocoa nibs. But I love them in ice cream. They add a really nice crunch and they add some more sweetness. And frankly, they add lots of antioxidants, really healthy. Sometimes I'll add nuts, sometimes I'll add seeds, whatever I have on hand. It's just amazing. And it's a great base. You can add whatever frozen fruit or even just fresh fruit along with the frozen bananas. Just delicious, especially with the cocoa powder. It just really adds a nice addition. So I love me my banana and ice cream. That is what I'm sharing with you. Sometimes I have it for dinner. Yes, you heard me. Dinner. Now, the only downside to bananas, in my opinion, in general, as a food, is that unless you live in the tropics, they are not a local food. And of course, they are a monocrop. I don't love that. They are a food I buy most regularly that isn't locally grown. And because of unfair labor practices in the banana industry, I do buy only fairly traded bananas. So those are things to look out for regarding bananas. Enough said about bananas, but I do want to hear if you start making banana and ice cream or if you already make it and what your favorite mixes and toppings are. Okay, so let's switch to a savory food and move on to the second favorite food in my list, and that is cauliflower. I eat cauliflower probably every day. Cauliflower is a definite favorite. If I wanted to simplify things, I could just say that brassica vegetables are my favorite because they are. However, since I already made kale one of my favorites in a previous podcast episode of my favorite foods and I chose Brussels sprouts for another, it makes sense to single out another favorite brassica, and it deserves its own. Cauliflower deserves its own. They each deserve their own episode. And so in this case, this would be cauliflower. What's a brassica, you ask? Well, brassica is the name for a genus of plants in the mustard family, also and informally known as cruciferous vegetables, cabbages, mustard plants. The word brassica was Pliny the Elder's word for cabbage-like plant. And brassica species and varieties include bok choy, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, collard, kale, kohlrabi, Napa cabbage, Savoy cabbage, rape or rapini, or broccoli rabe, rutabaga, turnip. These are all brassicas. And I love every one of these vegetables. I could do episodes just on each one of them. No, I'm not planning on doing that, but I could. I love every one of these vegetables. So let's talk about cauliflower. I find it a wonderfully versatile vegetable that I eat raw, cooked, pureed, fried, pickled, baked, roasted, and of course, the newest way for everyone to prepare cauliflower that's all the rage is buffalo cauliflower, which I'll come back to. It's so funny how food trends become so prominent. And so as I said, I eat cauliflower almost every day because I put them in salads, which I eat almost every day. Sometimes I don't even have a green salad. I'll just make a cauliflower salad. I just add some rice vinegar. And especially when avocados are in season, I add avocado, a little salt, sometimes nutritional yeast, and that will be my salad. Or, and I could eat a head in, you know, just a, in a sitting. Or I'll chop the cauliflower really finely and make a cauliflower quinoa salad tossed with some lemon juice, some fresh herbs, or whatever other veggies you want to mix in. So I love cauliflower for a salad. If I don't eat it raw, I love eating it straight out of the air fryer. Technically, I would call this roasted cauliflower because it's the same result whether you cook it in the air fryer or the oven, but the air fryer is just a much less resource-intensive method of cooking, especially when it comes to roasting. I just find that it's just so much energy used when you roast vegetables because you have to turn the oven on really high and it takes a while for the vegetables to roast. So air fryer was a game changer for me. The first game changer appliance-wise, well, I don't know, probably a long time ago, it was something like the food processor, but recently it would have been the pressure cooker and now the air fryer. The best thing ever for essentially roasted vegetables. And truly, I think the brassicas lend themselves to the air fryer more than anything else. So chop them up, add a little bit of oil. You don't have to add oil, but it's just, they're just dry if you don't. So I just prefer to add just enough to coat the vegetables, sprinkle on some salt, toss them. I also add like a chipotle chili powder, which I love. You can add some nutritional yeast, whatever. And then 7 minutes or so in the air fryer and you've got the best cauliflower on the planet. The cooking time will change depending on how much oil you have on, how small you cut the cauliflower, how crispy you like it, but it's about 5 to 7 minutes, could be 8. If you want kale chips, same thing, 5 minutes in the air fryer. Amazing. Broccolini, same thing. Probably my favorite thing in the air fryer next to the cauliflower. Yeah, it's probably my favorite. No, next to the kale. I don't know. Any of the brassicas in the air fryer is amazing. A little oil in the broccolini. I don't even put anything else except for a little oil, a little salt, and it's perfection. Amazing. My third favorite way of preparing cauliflower is as a risotto, basically making cauliflower rice for the risotto rather than using arborio rice, which is a typical rice grain that's used to make that really thick, creamy risotto. I just did this last night. I just made cauliflower mushroom risotto for David and I last night. I love this so much more than traditionally prepared risotto, which I love, but this is just lighter and more nutrient dense. It's not to say that I would never make the traditional risotto, but I love making cauliflower risotto. I do have a delicious recipe for it. I am sending it along to my Patreon supporters who are supporters at $10 a month and above. If you're not already a supporter, you might want to consider becoming one because I'm working on a lot of new recipes for new projects that are coming up, and I'm going to be sending these recipes through the Patreon system. So if you're already a patron, go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau. Well, I mean, I guess just go to patreon.com, log into your account, and you'll see the recipe there. If you're not a patron, go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau, and you can become a supporter. If you become a supporter at $10 a month and above, you will get these recipes on a regular basis. And one of them is for this California cauliflower risotto. It is California because I devised it in California. And I would say my fourth favorite way to prepare cauliflower is in a soup or a curry or a pureed curry soup. Cauliflower just really lends itself so beautifully, I think, to Indian and Thai curries. So I love preparing it hot with curry, either Indian curry spices or Thai curry spices or Thai curry paste. And I do already have recipes for aloo gobi, which is a traditional Indian dish made of curried cauliflower and potato in the vegan table, my cookbook, The Vegan Table, for example. And then I have curried cauliflower soup and purple cauliflower soup in Color Me Vegan, another cookbook of mine. In fact, on that note, I really encourage you also to try different color heads of cauliflower you see at the market. There's the traditional white cauliflower, there's yellow cauliflower, there's purple, there's green, and depending on what color you're eating, you're getting different antioxidants. It's one of the things I love so much about my book, Color Me Vegan. I just find it so fascinating that depending on the The color is determined by the phytochemicals in that food. And the colors have different properties that affect different organs in our bodies. And I think that's incredible. So the point is, the more color you eat, the more you're just getting lots of different antioxidants that and phytochemicals that support different organs in our own body. So it's pretty cool. And then, of course, you have the Romanesco cauliflower or Roman cauliflower, which is a really pretty chartreuse color. It's a very unique looking vegetable. Do a search for it if you've never seen it. It's Romanesco cauliflower. Some people think it's a cross between broccoli and cauliflower because it kind of looks that way, but it's actually botanically different. It's related, but it's different. So check that out. It's another brassica to try if you want to get on a brassica kick, which you should. I encourage it. And if you're a supporter, $10 a month and above, look also for the recipe for curried cauliflower soup in your Patreon account. My fifth favorite way to eat cauliflower is mashed. So basically using cauliflower instead of potatoes or in addition to potatoes. Not that I don't love me my mashed potatoes, my mashed Yukon gold yellow potatoes. Love mashed potatoes, but mashed cauliflower, it's delicious. It's just different, but it's more nutrient dense in its own way, and it's very easy to prepare. You can also just add it to mashed potatoes. Really adds a nice additional flavor and texture, and of course more nutrients. Now, another favorite way to eat cauliflower for a lot of people is buffalo cauliflower wings, which I do order a lot when they're available on restaurant menus, and they're on restaurant menus more and more these days. Listen to my podcast episode when I was traveling to Vancouver Island. They were everywhere, even in non-vegan restaurants. And weirdly, maybe because I don't eat out enough near me here in the San Francisco Bay Area. When you're traveling, obviously you eat out in restaurants more, but at home, maybe I just don't eat at enough restaurants because I never see them on menus out here in the Bay Area. I don't know what I'm missing, but I don't make them at home very often because I don't eat a lot of breaded, fried things, even though it can be done baked for sure. I just haven't done it much, though I know there are a ton of recipes out there for buffalo cauliflower wings. But since a huge aspect of what makes them delicious, other than the fried breaded aspect, is the buffalo sauce. Buffalo chicken wings, schmicken wings. Like, you can just put buffalo sauce on just cauliflower that you put in the air fryer. You don't have to fry them and bread them, or even bread them and bake them. You can just roast them, and then you can add buffalo sauce. So all I'm saying is get some buffalo sauce, stir fry up some cauliflower, or roast it, or put it in the air fryer, and then toss it with some buffalo sauce and you're golden. Although since it's spicy, a nice addition would be some kind of cooling ranch sauce. That's why that's often served with a buffalo, you know, cauliflower wing. You can make that at home. You can just use some kind of mashed avocado or commercially bought plant-based sour cream or ranch dressing. And for those asking, commercial buffalo sauce is a mixture of hot sauce, vinegar, Worcestershire sauce, butter, and seasoning. So not all bottled buffalo sauce will be animal product free. Just look at the ingredients. The brand Tabasco, which is typically known for its hot sauce, has a plant-based version. It's also easy to make at home. You can look on the web for recipes. And if you demand it, maybe I'll devise my own buffalo sauce recipe. In fact, I'm probably going to do that. Hang on, I'm going to put that note down for me for my next book. I'm really serious. Hang on. Okay, this is getting out of control, but I will offer just a few more favorite ways I eat cauliflower. I told you, I eat it every day. I just love it. One is as a gratin. You can check out my recipes for potatoes au gratin in the vegan table and swap out or add cauliflower, and you've got a fabulous cauliflower au gratin. And another would be making kind of a cauliflower and cheese instead of a macaroni and cheese. So basically a cauliflower bake, which is ridiculously good. And finally, pickled cauliflower. I'm really starting to play with pickling and fermenting foods. I cannot wait to share more of this with you. I have tempeh fermenting right now, and this week I'm actually going to start making miso, which won't be ready for 9 months or so, but I cannot wait to do this. So I'm going to do an episode. I mean, I will have a lot more to say about fermenting foods, but I'm also getting into pickling more. It's very new for me. It's very easy to pickle, but I have never done it. So I'm looking forward to getting into pickling. And so I don't make pickled cauliflower myself. I don't pickle it myself a lot. But when I'm out at restaurants, especially Millennium, Eric, the chef at Millennium, does pickling so well, and some of my favorite pickled foods has been by him. I'll get it when I'm out, but I don't tend to make it at home. But stay tuned. I'll have more to say on that. So as you can see, there are so many ways to prepare cauliflower. It's so delicious. It's so versatile. And that's all I have to say about cauliflower. Next favorite food, popcorn. How popcorn wasn't part of my very first five favorite foods episodes, I don't know. Now, it's a snack food. It's not exactly a dinner food, but as snacks go, you could do worse. I've always loved popcorn. When I was young, a little blast from the past, if those of you listening remember the Jiffy Pop. Remember Jiffy Pop? For those who don't know Jiffy Pop, just go on YouTube and just type in Jiffy Pop. It was like this amazing magical thing that happened on the stove. It was like magic. Jiffy Pop. And then, of course, movie popcorn. Who doesn't love the smell of popcorn in a movie theater? Today, luckily, I have graduated from Jiffy Pop, and my preferred method of cooking popcorn is with an air popper that I have had for 20 years. I've had this air popper for 20 years. Now, that's not to say that I don't add butter or oil to my popcorn afterwards, but I do prefer air popped to oil popped, but you can just oil pop it as well in a popcorn maker. I used to do that a lot. We used to have one that was specifically for popcorn so that you can turn it while it's on the stove. Or you can just use a big pot and then just toss it a bit as it's cooking. But I just find the air popper a lot cleaner, both from an eating standpoint and the cleanup. So I air pop my popcorn kernels. I distribute it to large bowls, and then I drizzle on some melted butter, sprinkle on some salt, nutritional yeast, and chili powder. Sometimes I use truffle salt, or I'll use a tiny bit of truffle oil with the melted butter. Now, from a zero waste perspective, while I don't use a lot of butter, I am able to compost the packaging of Miyoko's butter, as well as the Earth Balance sticks. Compost the paper cover, and then inside is the foil. I recycle that. It's one of the few products I buy in packaging when it comes to Miyoko's butter, both the paper that the butter's wrapped in and the paper coat, the package itself. Both can be composted. So I buy very few products in packaging, but because I can fully take responsibility, especially from Miyoko's, I will buy that in packaging. Though I don't buy the Earth Balance tubs anymore, just the sticks, because the cardboard and the wax paper, like I said, can go into my city's compost bins. Actually, the Earth Balance would be the foil. The cardboard can go into the compost bins, or I shred it myself and I add it to my own compost bin. So popcorn is also a great party food. When we host parties nowadays, since I'm not buying packaged snack foods, right? So I don't go to the store now and buy just all the chips and tortilla chips. I'll often make a big batch of popcorn, and that will be what I add to the repertoire of whatever else I'm serving that day, along with homemade tortilla chips, which is another episode altogether. So I also bring my own popcorn when I go to the movie theater. Not always, because a lot of movie theaters don't use butter unless you add it at the end. So oftentimes I'll get it there, but in terms of just, bringing my own, liking my own, knowing how I've cooked it, knowing I'm not using additional packaging, although I will take that paper popcorn bag home with me and compost it if I do get it from the theater. I do usually bring it with me when I go to the movie theater. One thing I love to make around the holidays is caramel popcorn, the recipe for which is in The Joy of Vegan Baking. It is such a fantastic gift, and it's a fantastic addition to bring or make for holiday parties, especially when you put it in one of those big tins. It's really impressive. It looks like it's very complicated to make, but it's really very simple. Speaking of holidays, threading popcorn to hang on the Christmas tree is also something I've done, but it is a lot of work, so I don't do it very often. Plus, I think Charlie, one of my kitties, he loves popcorn, so he'd probably just eat it all. Anyway, so one thing, I don't really know why I'm telling you this. You know how we all have kind of just little quirks in general and regarding how we eat some things? I have always had a very unique way of eating popcorn, and very few people know about this. Very few people know. My husband knows because he sees me do it all the time, and some friends who've come over to watch movies with me have now witnessed it. It's weird. I don't know what to tell you. I have been doing this since I was a child, and I can't eat popcorn any other way. I mean, I can technically, like if I go to a movie theater, I don't do this. So I'm able to control this quirk. But at home, when I'm sitting down to watch a movie with popcorn, it's second nature to eat popcorn this way. So I'd love to know if anybody else does this because I haven't met anybody else who does this. I have my big old bowl of popcorn. When I go down to watch my movie, I also bring a small empty bowl. Then, bear with me, it's going to sound really weird. I eat my popcorn. First, I eat the end, like the part that doesn't pop, the little germ part that, you know, that's kind of rough, that that's at the very end of the bowl, right? So I eat that first, and then I leave the fluffy popcorn ball, and that goes into my little empty bowl. And I do that with each popcorn kernel until my little bowl is filled with fluffy popcorn balls. I can't believe I'm telling you this. Once I have my little bowl of popcorn balls, then I eat them all at once. I know it sounds totally weird, but the little balls eaten all at once, I mean, I don't eat them all at once. Like, I don't shove them all into my mouth, but I mean, I eat them as like their own little snack, eating the balls all at once, having just, you know, created the little balls. It's just, I don't know, it's really good. And it's just the way I eat popcorn. Try it. I want to know if you've ever done this, but I want to know if you try it. And like, you can't just like eat a, like, don't just make the popcorn balls and then like eat five. Make an entire bowl of popcorn balls and then eat them, you know, then eat them all at once, like not interspersing with the regular popcorn, just like eat the popcorn balls all on their own. They're so good. Okay, it'll be our little secret if you tell me that you do this. I want to know if you do this. Okay, moving on. I have no secrets and no weird idiosyncrasies regarding sweet potatoes, but Japanese sweet potatoes would be my next favorite food. Obviously more nutrient dense than popcorn. Now, not just sweet potatoes, but Japanese sweet potatoes, kind of one of the best things ever. And I think anyone who's ever enjoyed Japanese sweet potatoes would agree that they are just the best things ever. I think there's even an emoji for Japanese sweet potatoes. How cool is that? Now, when I talk about Japanese sweet potatoes, I'm talking about those that have a very deep magenta skin, but white flesh that turns like a champagne gold when it's cooked. Traditionally grown in Japan and Okinawa, these sweet potatoes are now available at grocery stores across North America, I would imagine, across Europe as well. It's a staple food for the Okinawans, who are some of the healthiest and longest lived people on earth. Their good health and long lifespan are attributed in part to their diet, and the Japanese sweet potato is distinct from the Okinawan sweet potato, which is purple fleshed. They eat both in abundance, but you've got the Japanese sweet potato that's eaten by the Okinawans and obviously by the Japanese, and then you've got the Okinawan sweet potato, which is purple fleshed, which is also delicious and also something I encourage you to eat, but it's the Japanese sweet potato that I'm talking about here. They're simultaneously drier and creamier than the orange fleshed sweet potato. Try to say that fast. The orange fleshed sweet potatoes, which means that you roast them at high heat, as cubes, wedges, circles, halves, whatever. Just chop them up. I mean, I would just have them up, make little circles or wedges, coat them with a tiny bit of olive oil and cook them. Now that's one way to do it. What I tend to do, and I do this very often, I eat sweet potatoes several times a week. They're so sweet. They're so sweet. I mean, again, in terms of getting rid of all of the kind of more commercial and artificial sweet foods that we're so accustomed to eating, once you start just relying on whole foods for sweetness, you will just be blown away. They've got this like chestnutty, earthy sweetness. And the only adornment you need, in my opinion, is a little bit of salt. I do think the little bit of salt brings out the flavor a little bit more. So my preferred method of eating them is either baking them first in the convection oven or steaming them in a pressure cooker and doing a bunch all at once. And then either eating one immediately because they're so good, and I just eat them up without even really, sometimes without even sprinkling salt on them. But once they're baked or steamed, however you just bake them whole, you know, I pierce holes in them, fork holes, I just pierce a bunch of little holes in them, and then I bake them in my little convection oven, my, you know, that's a countertop convection oven or toaster oven, or you can use a regular oven do a bunch at once. Once they're baked through, then I put them in a Tupperware container and I put them in the refrigerator. You know, cool them first and then put them in the refrigerator. When it comes time to eat them, when I want to eat them for a meal, I take them out and I do the best thing ever. I put them in the air fryer. I either split one or two, depending on the size, down the middle, and I smash a bit of the flesh with the fork, or, and then put them face up in the air fryer, or I slice them whole, again, these are baked, into discs, and I put them in the air fryer like that. In both cases, no oil, nothing, just the air fryer. Sometimes when I do this with the discs, I will line the air fryer bottom with parchment paper that I've poked holes in so that the sweet potatoes don't stick to the bottom of the air fryer, which can be a pain to clean, but pretty much that's it. In both cases, whether it's the whole sliced, smashed sweet potato or that sweet potato cut into discs, and again, I'm going to emphasize this is once they're already baked. You can certainly put them right in the air fryer once when they're raw, but I find the flavor so much better baking them first. In both cases, it would be about 7 to 10 minutes on the highest setting, depending on how large the sweet potatoes are and how large the discs are. The result in the case of the whole split potato is a perfect, hot, creamy, fleshy inside and a crispy skin. Even the flesh, it's like a twice-baked potato. The flesh is even, you know, somewhat browned. It's amazing. At that point, I either drizzle a little balsamic vinegar and sprinkle a little salt, or I'll spread a little bit of butter on with some salt, or you can just eat them just like that. I mean, just plain. There are lots of things you can do. You can top them with lots of vegetables or what have you, but that's just a basic foundation. I'm getting so excited, I can't find my words. It's a basic foundation for sweet potato, and then you can do anything you want after that. Something I've been meaning to try, and maybe we can do it together. I've been meaning to try this, and I just made some peanut butter today, and I do have Japanese sweet potatoes in my refrigerator, is to open up that steamed sweet potato, or like I said, after you split it and smash it, the flesh inside with a fork, and then put it in the air fryer, spreading it with peanut butter and jam, like fig jam. Wrap it in parchment paper and bring it out on the road. How amazing does that sound? I think I saw that somewhere on the internet. I've been meaning to try that. So for the discs, I usually just sprinkle on some salt. And I'll be honest, they're fantastic snacks. I think I mentioned in a recent podcast episode that they're fantastic snacks for the road, especially when you're going on a plane or on a car ride or on a hike. Just put those discs in an air fryer, put them in a container, and you've got a really hearty, filling, nutritious snack for the road. What else can I say? What else can I say? I can't say anymore. You just have to try them and you won't be sorry. You will be unsorry, if that's a word. And I want to know how it goes. Finally, I really went back and forth about the fifth favorite food to include on this episode. I was thinking of making it persimmons. Fuyu, of course, persimmons, not the hajicha, God no. I may do an episode on those another time, but I tend to eat them only in the fall. Not everybody can get them. And then I was thinking how I used to hate olives and now love them. I talked about my hatred for mushrooms on the episode I would have done on shiitake mushrooms, because they were my gateway mushroom. Shiitake mushrooms were my gateway mushroom. My gateway olive into loving olives was the Casa Voltrano olive from Sicily. They're the reason I started liking olives. They're so good. They're ridiculously good. Okay. Now, other olives can be a little mushy, not mushy, but soft. I mean, some of them can be mushy. Casa Voltrano's are firm, where other olives can be aggressively salty, which my husband loves, to be honest. Casa Voltrano's are mild. They're not super salty. Where other olives are kind of muddy shades of brown, Casa Voltrano olives are this gorgeous pale shade of green, like a Kermit the Frog green hue, just beautiful green color. The Casa Voltrano is, it's really large. It's almost fruit-like. It's very tender. It's very meaty. There's no other word to describe them. They're meaty, they're buttery, and the flavor is really mild. So even if you don't like olives, or if you've said that you don't like olives because you've tried olives and you didn't like them, don't do what I did, which was say that I didn't love olives but never really tried them. If you have tried olives that you don't love, try Casa Vetrano olives. I am telling you, they will change you. They will turn olive haters into olive lovers. Now, one thing I would recommend is get them with the pits already in them. I just think they're better that way. I never buy them jarred. I only buy them. They've become so popular that you should be able to find them at any olive bar in, you know, any kind of fresh grocery store or grocery store that has a fresh olive bar. They're really popular these days. So I think you'll be able to find them. If you can only find them jarred, then do that. But I don't think I've ever bought them jarred. I have had them when they're already pitted. Don't even bother. Just get the ones that still have the pits in them, and they're absolutely delicious. Okay, so what to do with them? Eat them. Just eat them. Find a local, you know, shop that has them in at the olive bar. Serve them with Marcona almonds, the little salty almonds. Like, they're great for a wine party or a sparkling non-alcoholic party. They do really pair well with a nice white wine. But honestly, I don't really do a lot with Casa Vetrano olives other than eat them, because they're just perfect. But you can, I don't know, you can make olive salads with them. You can add them to salads. Actually, it's not true. I have added them to salads, but it's just one of those foods that it's amazing that I even chop them up and put them in anything, because I eat them as I'm chopping them up. Now, that's not to say that I don't like other olives. As I said, the Casa Vetrano olive was my gateway olive, which means I now eat and pretty much love all other olives. I'm not going to name all the ones I like, because I would sound like I know what I'm talking about, when in fact I know very little about other olives, other than, I don't know, I mean, the Kalamata olives. I don't even know. I don't know a lot about other olives other than the Casa Vetrano olives, because they're my best friend. They're amazing. Check them out. Let me know what you think. I want to hear what you think. So that's it. I thought you might enjoy a food-related episode, since it's a long time since I've done one, which, in my defense, the podcast is called Food for Thought, not Fought for Food. So I have an excuse there. So as I mentioned, I'm giving recipes to supporters at $10 a month and above. If you're already a supporter, go to your Patreon account. If you are at a lower amount, you might want to change it. If you're not a supporter at all, what are you waiting for? Like I said, this is a 100% listener supported podcast, and I've got lots of episodes coming up for you in the coming year. There are lots of perks at different levels, and your support means I can keep putting out the content that has been changing hearts and minds for 20 years now. In general, the podcast is going on its 14th year, and the reason I'm able to do this is because of supporters like you. So go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau, or you can find the link to support at ColleenPatrickGaudreau.com. Oodles of love. Stay in touch. Let me know what you think about those foods. For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening. I'm going to go have some cauliflower now.